Okay, so thanks for giving me a chance to talk in the seminar. Thanks also, Daniel, for inviting me to visit PI. So, pleasure to be here. So I'm going to talk about a classical algorithm for a quantum problem. And this quantum problem is that of finding ground states of one-dimensional local Hamiltonians. So I know some people in the audience are absolute experts on this kind of problem, much more than I am. And some of you maybe are not experts on the problem. So the talk is geared for the less experts on the problem. Although I do hope to get to say something interesting, but I'll start by introducing, motivating the problem a little bit broadly. And then the objective of the talk is to give you an overview of this algorithm, what it does, and what's interesting about it. I'll start broadly with this observation that we're all very familiar with, which is that the classical description size of quantum systems scales exponentially with the number of particles. So throughout the talk, d will be the dimension of local systems. You think of d as a small dimension, it's like d10 or something like this, maybe 5. And n is the number of systems, so it is the parameter that will scale. And as n grows, the number of particles increases, the number of degrees of freedom of your system scales exponentially, or it scales as d to the n. And Feynman saw the subtlety here, and because he suggested that, well, you know, if quantum systems are so complex, and then also this gives them a certain amount of power. So let's use quantum computers in order to simulate quantum systems. Of course, maybe we don't have quantum computers yet, or we might have, you know, some kind of special purpose quantum computer, maybe, that accomplishes certain tasks. Even if we have those computers, I want to argue that it's still interesting to consider doing classical simulations of quantum systems for a host of reasons. I mean, the most basic reasons are just sort of fundamental physics reasons. You could say that if you have a quantum simulation, then presumably this will let you access some specific type of observables about the system that you're interested in. In a way, you could say that the classical simulation of a quantum system is a more complete, because it presumably it lets you compute many more properties of the system. That's the fundamental reason. There's also sort of philosophical reasons related to the problem of testing quantum mechanics, right? You have a theory that makes certain predictions. If you simulate a quantum system using another quantum system, then basically the only thing that you're checking is that quantum mechanics is self-consistent, right? These rules sort of work through to simulation. But you're not really testing the theory. So being able to perform classical simulations is really a necessary precondition to being able to test the predictions, be able to compute and test the predictions that your theory makes. So I'm going to look at this problem of simulation, and one interesting thing that it really gets at, this problem of when can you give classical simulations for quantum systems, is the physical reality of this exponential scaling, right? We're saying here that generically, you just can't represent classically quantum states. There's too many parameters. But when you do a classical simulation, then this is exactly what you're doing. You are representing a quantum state using a much smaller number of parameters. So the question is, you know, in general, you have this very large exponential size Hilbert space. But then there's a small, possibly a small corner of that Hilbert space which contains all the, maybe all the physically relevant states, or all the states that show up in your experiments. And so the goal of this, you know, whole area or program of doing simulations would be sort of map out this small space here and be able to perform computations in the small relevant chunk of the exponentially large Hilbert space. So we're going to be looking at this problem in sort of the simplest case of interest, which is that of ground states of one-dimensional local Hamiltonians. So I'm going to define those and tell you how I represent them. So first, the states. So we're going to be looking at states that are on, so there's these local d-dimensional systems, so spins or whatever of dimension d. D is 2, 4, 10. And there's n of them. And I'll represent them pictorially in this way. So you can think of this at different levels. This is a matrix product state, for those of you who are familiar with matrix product states. And I'll explain that a little bit. But to follow the talk, if you've never seen matrix product states before, you can really think of this pictorially. This is just a pictorial representation of my vector. Mathematically, what it is that each of these blobs here that has three legs is a tensor. So it's a three-dimensional array, like a matrix, but with three faces. There's one leg pointing down, and this is what I'd call the physical leg. It's d-dimensional face. And then you have horizontal legs. These are called the logical bonds. They're b-dimensional. B is a parameter. It's called the bond dimension of the state. So this here has three indices, one that ranges from 1 to b, another from 1 to b, and one from 1 to d. And this is just a three-dimensional array. when I link legs together, I'm performing some kind of matrix multiplication. So I'm multiplying this tensor by this tensor along that face that's indexed by this leg. So that when you look at this whole object here, I've multiplied through all the horizontal legs, and I only have vertical legs. And these vertical legs correspond to my physical qubits. So this is a representation of a vector in CD, tensor CD, tensor CD, tensor CD. So either you get the tensor picture, and it's good, you can use it, or you don't, and just think of this as a picture of a vector. This picture lets you do a lot of computations. For instance, if you're interested in computing the overlap of the vector psi here with a basis state, so there's a tensor product state, the only thing you need to do is plug in the corresponding tensors and perform the corresponding multiplications leg by leg. Now, when I've closed all the legs, this one should be closed as well, this evaluates to a number, and that number is the overlap here. One thing you can notice is that I didn't draw the horizontal bonds for this here. So this one is a tensor product state. Tensor product states have this horizontal dimension, b here equals to 1. In general, b could be anything. Actually, if you count degrees, number of parameters, b can be exponentially large. It could be as large as, it could need to be as large as d to the n to represent an arbitrary vector. But other than that, any vector can be represented in this form. B quantifies the amount of entanglement that exists across the different sites in your quantum state. That's the representation that I'll use for vectors. And now we have the Hamiltonian. So what's the local Hamiltonian? It's just a sum of matrices like these. So each of these hi terms is a d squared by d squared positive matrix. I'll just assume they're positive. So Hermitian positive, norm at most 1. This is just a normalization condition. If you want to think simple, you could even think of each of these terms as a projection. Projection which acts on two neighboring qubits. This is why I'm saying it's d squared by d squared. In fact, this will be d to the n by d to the n, so you should really tensor these matrices by identity on the qubits on which they don't act. And so pictorially, I can represent these local Hamiltonians like this. So the first one acts on my qubits 1 and 2, and then 3 and 4, et cetera. And then these are for the odd terms, and then also have even terms that act across the other neighbors. So this is clear because this kind of picture I'll use all the time. But if someone has a question, what's your Hamiltonian? What's your qubit? Something like this that's confusing. You can ask it now. It's OK. Everyone's familiar with this kind of picture. All right. And so given the Hamiltonian, the object that we're interested in is the ground state. The ground state is the eigenvector of the Hamiltonian with the lowest eigenvalue. So it minimizes the energy. E0 is the notation that I'll use for energy. And because this Hamiltonian is a sum of terms, you can decompose this energy like this as a sum of energies of the ground state with respect to each of the local Hamiltonians. And so our goal is given a description of the local Hamiltonian as input. So this has only n minus 1 times d to the 4 parameters. So I can definitely, classical description. I have a classical description for it of size polynomial, linear in n. The goal is to compute a description of the ground state. And I want a description that's useful. In what sense? Well, it should be, from the description, I should be able to compute, for instance, local observables, such as the energy, right? So this description should be a vector that lets me compute the energy. So a matrix product state representation where the bond dimension B would be polynomial, this is such a representation. This is what we're going to be looking for. All right, so what's known about this problem, computing classical descriptions or approximating the energy, the ground state energy of a local Hamiltonian? Well, there's a lot of practical successes. So if you try to do this, and people do it all the time because they want to do simulations for these one-dimensional systems, it works pretty well. So the first thing that works pretty well is that we do have candidates for what the classical description of the ground state should look like, right? It shouldn't be just a list of amplitudes. That would be d to the n numbers, is way too much. So we have these matrix product states that I just presented, or generalizations called MERA in one dimension, something called PEPS that works in two dimensions. So they're kind of networks that look like this. And these are candidates for what kind of descriptions we should be looking for in terms of our ground states. So in one dimensions, we even have algorithms. So there's an algorithm called DMRG, Density Matrix Renormalization Group, is introduced more than 20 years ago, that works very well. So you give it a one-dimensional local Hamiltonian, and it's going to sort of locally optimize over matrix product states, and typically going to find a description for something that is the ground state. Or when you know what the ground state should be, it seems to be finding it. But there's no rigorous analysis of this algorithm. And you know, there's examples. You can construct examples, artificial examples, in which the algorithm gets stuck in local minimum. So it's known that it doesn't always work, even though in practice it seems to be working most of the time. And so actually, by studying the computational complexity of the problem, we in fact do know that the algorithm cannot work all the time. So that's there's companion hardness results to these sort of heuristic algorithms. And so the main such result due to Kitaev is says that this exact problem approximating the ground state energy is a QMA hard problem. Sort of assuming everybody has seen QMA before. If you haven't, it's the quantum analog of the class NP. When you say that the problem is QMA hard, basically it means that it's hard. So there's no polynomial time algorithm for that problem. But I guess most people know about QMA. All right? And so that's for generic, or actually for local, but not geometrically local, Hamiltonians, their ground state energy. But this result by Kitaev has been pushed forward a lot in recent years. And now we know that the hardness result applies even to simple cases. So these cases here, one that's most relevant to this talk is that if you take even one-dimensional systems, two local Hamiltonians, these local Hamiltonians act on particles of dimension, I think, 8 each, then it's still QMA hard to approximate the ground state energy. So this means there are very simple local one-dimensional Hamiltonians that you can write down such that no algorithm is going to find you any reasonable approximation to the ground state. In particular, DMRG is not going to work, right, for these special cases. Another thing that it's saying is that not only the algorithm is not going to work, but in fact, these representations here will not capture your ground state. If, for instance, the ground state of these systems could be represented by a matrix product state, then this would put the problem in NP, which we believe is a smaller class than QMA. So provided you believe there's complexity class separation, which is something most complexity theorists believe, then there is no efficient classical description for the ground state of these problems generically. So the question is, what's going on, right? So here I'm saying there's hardness results, and then there's practical successes. So one thing that's interesting to ask is, OK, so hardness results, they're always worst case hardness, right? What this is saying is that there exists a two local Hamiltonian for which finding the ground state is a hard problem. What this is saying is, well, in most cases, I can find it. It works. So if you try to be a little bit more precise about why does it work, how can you characterize the difference between these sort of average case successes and the worst case, then you're looking for what are the parameters that distinguish, you know, these examples from these examples. And so one outcome of this work is to find one such parameter. I mean, people, of course, knew what the structure should be, and this structure is the spectral gap. So we're going to introduce one more parameter of the local Hamiltonian, which is the gap between the ground state energy, so the lowest energy, and the energy of the first excited state, or the second lowest eigenvalue. So I'll call it E1. This is when you minimize the energy over states that are orthogonal to the ground state. And then throughout the remainder of the talk, I'm going to assume that my Hamiltonians are gapped in that sense. So there's no degeneracy for the ground state, and there's a gap above the ground space. So one result that sort of put this gap at the forefront of you know, an important parameter to look at for local Hamiltonians is famous real law by Hastings, who showed almost 10 years ago now that gapped one-dimensional systems satisfy in a real law. So what does this mean? It's easier to explain in two dimensions. You have a nicer picture. So if you look at a state on a two-dimensional grid, and you look at a certain subregion here, and you look at the amount of entanglement that crosses from the subregion to the remainder of the grid, generically, you measure it by, say, von Neumann entropy, right? So generically, this amount of entanglement would scale as the volume of this region here. The real law says that, in fact, for ground states of gapped Hamiltonians, it should scale as the perimeter of the region, so the area here, which is quadratically smaller in two dimensions. So two dimensions is a real law, is in fact a conjecture, but it's proved in one dimension. And one consequence of this area law, if you push it a little bit forward, if you prove it not for the von Neumann entropy, but for stronger notions of entropy, is what I already mentioned before, that the ground state has a efficient matrix product state representation. So how efficient? Well, this bond dimension here, the parameter B that we had before, it's enough to take it polynomial in the length of the chain and the approximation quality that you want. So this is already saying one thing. It's saying that, OK, if you impose the gap, then the problem is in NP. In particular, presumably, it's not QMA hard. So the examples, the hard examples that I had in my previous slides, these do not correspond to gapped Hamiltonians. So that gives a hope that we can maybe fill in this picture here. So we have this very large Hilbert space that contains all states, but we can decompose it into two parts, right? There's going to be the part of the sort of the physical easy states, the one that satisfies the Urea law, and then we have an efficient description, maybe an efficient algorithm. And then the remainder of the Hilbert space would be states that have a volume scaling. They don't satisfy the Urea law. They don't have an efficient description. Of course, if they don't have an efficient description, we can't find them efficiently either. The question is whether this picture is accurate. So an important result here is a result by Sirak, Shuk, and Verstrate. What they showed is that this is not the correct picture, not quite. They showed that still you can construct 1D local Hamiltonians such that the ground state has an efficient representation. But finding this ground state is hard. At least it's as hard as factoring, which we don't, you know, presumably is a hard problem. So there's at least one thing wrong about this picture is the efficient algorithm here, right? I put this zone of states that satisfy an Urea law, have an efficient representation. This result is saying the fact that there exists an efficient representation doesn't mean that you're going to find it. So there's cases, this is sort of giving a, almost proof that there's cases for which DMRG doesn't find the ground state, even though there is a small size MPS for that ground state, but it's not found. So it's saying a real law is not a sufficient condition. And so what our work, I'm getting to our result now, shows with, you know, I mean, of course it's not a big surprise, but the result is that a real law is not a sufficient condition. What's a sufficient condition is the gap. So gap applies a real law. A real law doesn't imply anything, but gap itself implies efficient algorithm. So here's the result. We have an algorithm which takes as input local Hamiltonian, just exactly the kind I described before, and outputs a matrix product state representation for the ground state. So there's a little precision parameter delta here that you can choose. I mean, think of it as being a small constant. But if you want it to go to zero with the length of the chain, that's fine too. Delta could be 1 over n, 1 over n squared. And the running time can be expressed like this. So the first important thing to notice is that it's polynomial in n, the length of the chain, and in the inverse of the precision that you require. But it has a very bad dependence on two parameters, this d and this delta. So that's this exponent here. So you can notice, for instance, that the algorithm running time has the inverse gap. It's doubly exponential in the inverse gap. So if my gap is a constant, this exponent is a constant. If my gap closes, even pretty slowly as the system size increases, then the algorithm will no longer be polynomial time. Right? That's pretty bad. It also has a pretty bad dependence on the local dimension. Again, if d is a constant, like 2 or 10, like I said before, it's fine. This is a constant. It's going to run. But if you want to increase the local dimension of your systems, then the running time will blow up very fast. Another sort of side comment is the algorithm has a very tiny component of it, which is probabilistic. So it's not a deterministic algorithm. I'll point to that later, right at the end of the talk. It's just a small part, but it's just worth pointing out that it's a randomized algorithm. You can make the probability of success as, you know, as close to one as you want by repeating it many times. So do you have questions on the statement of the result? It's clear so far? I'm going to sort of progressively go into explaining what are the ideas of the algorithm now, how it works. So if there's anything that's unclear, you can stop. So I'll sort of introduce the ideas progressively. First, I have a very high-level executive summary that I'll describe right now. Then I'll give you a little bit of a picture and give you some of the main ideas. Then I'll describe the algorithm and be a little bit more concrete, and then probably my time will be up. So what's the executive summary? This is what you want to remember if there's just one thing that you get out of the talk. What's the problem that we're trying to solve to start with? It's a very simple problem, right? We have a Hamiltonian, and we're trying to minimize the energy. So we're trying to find pure state, or here I just wrote it as a density matrix. We're trying to find the density matrix which minimizes the energy. That's just the lowest eigenvalue problem, right? We're trying to find the lowest eigenvalue of this matrix. Of course, the problem is that this is an exponential size matrix. So you have an exponential size lowest eigenvalue to compute. This is what makes it hard if you just go at it brute force. And so the whole point is to use the structure of the Hamiltonian. This is exponential size matrix, but not any exponential size matrix. It's decomposed into a sum of local terms. We want to use this structure in order to get an efficient algorithm. And so here's how we're going to do it. We're going to construct this solution here, so this representation for the ground state that we're looking for, progressively, one step at a time, by considering more and more qubits. So we're going to consider a whole set of intermediate problems where I look at only the first I terms of my Hamiltonian. These acts on qubit, this is 1 and 2, et cetera. So these acts on the qubits that go up to I plus 1. So I'm restricting my space. This should be, I guess, a I plus 1. I'm restricting my space to the first I plus 1 qubits and solving the problem on that subspace. And I'm going to extend, solve it on progressively bigger spaces. So if you do this naively, I mean, at first it's fine, right? I mean, at first, if I consider just the first term or the first two terms, then I have a constant size problem. I can definitely solve this when I have H1, H1 plus H2, I can do it, right? The problem is, as I add more and more Hamiltonians, every time the dimension of my space, one more qubit, gets multiplied by d. So if I do it, if I continue like this without doing anything special, I get an exponential size space, right? So the point is to use the fact that we solved the problem in the previous case in order to help with the next case. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to carry around a certain amount of information throughout the different steps. And this amount of information will be a subspace of the total space that is polynomial dimension and also has a basis that you can represent using polynomial size matrix product states. And so at every step, I'm going to solve the next problem, one more Hamiltonian, but I'm going to solve it not on the full space of the I qubits, but on a polynomial size subspace. This is the subspace called Si here. And as long as we keep a polynomial size subspace that has, you know, efficient representations that we can work with, then we're going to be able to solve the problem at each step. The difficulty is to guarantee that you have these subspaces that remain of polynomial size, and such that, of course, you sort of have a promise that you're carrying around that the solution you're looking for, that this ground state, can be found in these subspaces. That's what we want. So I have a picture sort of representing what we're trying to do or why this is not an easy task. So this is a different picture than last time I gave the talk. It was. So you can think of what we're this iterative process. This is kind of like, and this is a picture just that you can keep in mind for to sort of carry through the arguments that I'll give, more precise arguments that I'll give later. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to, exactly this. So we're trying to pull this sled across a lake. So the sled sort of represents this polynomial size subspace that we're constructing progressively and we're carrying around. It's a set of candidate solutions that we're extending. And we're trying to pull these set of candidate solutions all across the lake until we reach the last qubit, until we reach something that contains the ground state. But of course, life is not easy, and there's a snowstorm going on. There's a lot of things that are going to get on our way. For instance, things like, you know, the ice could melt. So one thing that's going to happen is that as you go across, the sled is going to accumulate snow. Snow will represent sort of the size of this set that grows and grows. And if you let it grow naively, it'll become of exponential size. So you have to find ways to get rid of this snow, reduce the size of the set that you're carrying around. The other thing is that you have to make sure you don't get lost. And this is approximation errors. So there's always going to be, you know, a certain quality of this subspace that you're keeping. How good of an approximation to the ground state does it contain? And this quality will get sort of thrown off from time to time. And so we have to introduce a tool to improve this approximation quality. OK, so that's a picture, right? So now I want to give you three ideas that go into the algorithm. And then we'll put them together, describe the algorithm, and then it'll be a little bit more precise as to how these three ideas are used. So three ideas are sort of associated to the picture. So I'll explain them now. So the first, maybe most important thing, this is the one definition that you need to understand in order to follow the remainder of the talk, is what is this sled? So what is this set? What is this subspace that we're constructing in which we're sort of promised to find the ground state? So something we call not a sled, we call it a viable set. And viable set is something that looks like this. So it's a set. It's a set of vectors. It's a set of vectors that are represented by matrix product states. And these matrix product states lie on the first I qubits. So I'm going to construct such a set for every I, starting from I equals 1, et cetera. So it's just a set of matrix product states, as I had before, that has just one particular property. So it's a set such that I have a guarantee that there exists a good approximation to the ground state. So delta approximation, think of a state that's delta close in two norm or has overlap 1 minus delta. It doesn't really matter. This delta here will be 1 over n squared or something like that. It's a small parameter. So all ways of measuring approximation are sort of equivalent. So this set has the guarantee that there exists a good approximation to the ground state whose reduced density matrix on the first I qubits is supported on the span of the set. Another way to say it is if you look at the ground state or close approximation to it, and you do the Schmidt decomposition between the ith qubit, left and right, then the Schmidt vectors on the left, these will be not necessarily in my set, but they'll be in the span of the set. So there's these three parameters here. I will be, you know, which qubit we're looking at. Delta is a measure of the approximation quality. And this S I haven't explained yet. This is just the size of the set. I'm going to be a little bit loose. I mean, size would be the number of vectors in the set, but it'll also be a bound on the complexity of representing these vectors. So in practice, S will also be a bound on this parameter B here. So really what this is, this viable set, you think of it as a succinct basis, right? It's a polynomial basis, a polynomial size, polynomial representation for the physically relevant corner of Hilbert space. So this kind of space that we were looking for before, if we managed to construct it. Of course, you have to show that this thing exists and that you can construct it. Well, one thing that follows from the area law is that it does exist. So for any I that you look at, this is something I said before, right? There is a matrix product state representation that has polynomial size and polynomial bond dimension. That is a good approximation to the ground state. So if you just took this one good approximation to the ground state, do the Schmidt decomposition, take the left vectors, take matrix product state representations, put them in your set, that's a good viable set, right? That works. And there's only polynomially many such vectors. The problem is, how did I construct this viable set? I said, well, start from a good approximation to the ground state and look at the left Schmidt vectors. We don't have this good approximation to the ground state, so we're going to have to find other ways to construct this viable set. And so the question is, how do you construct them? In particular, if I set I to n, so if I look at the sort of the last such set, the one that's defined on all the vectors, and if you stare at the definition, you see that the definition is saying that that set supports a good approximation to the ground state. That's it, a good approximation to the ground state itself. So I'm not explaining exactly why, but if you're given n, 1 over n squared, let's say, polynomial size, viable set, then by minimizing the energy over the span of that space, you can find a good approximation to the ground state using the fact that the Hamiltonian is gapped. So minimizing the energy will give you a good approximation to the ground state. All right. No questions on this? All right, so we're going to construct this thing. So we're going to construct it iteratively, sort of by taking one such thing for I minus 1 and constructing the one for I. And this construction of the naive way to do this will involve like blowing up the size of the set, sort of making it much bigger. And this is our sled accumulating snow. So in order to keep things of a reasonable size, we have to find a way to control things reasonable. We have to find a way to control the size of these viable sets. So there's going to be one main way in which we do that, and that's the next idea I want to introduce. So this idea relies on the one-dimensional structure of the problem. It's an idea that was introduced in previous works. It's called decoupling. So it's, in computer science, we'd call it divide and conquer, or maybe dynamic programming in a certain way. So let's look at the object that we're trying to construct. So it's this matrix product state representation for the ground state, or an approximation to it. This is what we want. But at any given step, what we have is a subspace which contains, let's say, loosely, these halves, right? So it contains good approximations for the left, but not for the right. And let's say I manage to construct these left vectors, but I have tons of them. They're sort of candidates. I don't know which ones are the good candidates, which ones are the wrong ones. I want to do a little bit of clearing up, sort of get rid of maybe some useless left halves. So what's important about my problem, what I do want to maintain, is that among these vectors, the ones that I keep are the ones that are important, the ones that will be part of the approximation to the ground state. And so these are those that minimize the energy in the sense that there's a way to complete them into something that has minimal energy. Now, if you look at this energy computation, just because the energy is, just because the Hamiltonian is a sum of term, you can decompose it as a sum of two terms. This is the energy of the first I minus one terms plus the energy of the remaining I terms. So now, how do you compute each of these energies here? Well, for the terms that act on the left, for instance, this term here, hi minus 1, this acts only on these qubits. So if I have this information here, which is how my state should look like on the left. To compute the energy, I contract it like this, and I contract all the bonds. And then I can choose my normalization condition. I guess I should maybe have said this before, but let's choose a normalization condition such that when you contract things from the right, then you always have the condition that this contracts to something trivial, to the identity, so it contracts like this. So if I choose this normalization condition, then in fact, all these terms here do not depend on the right-hand side. It doesn't matter what the right-hand side is going to be. Only the left matters to compute this. OK, but now we also have the right-hand side, right? So what about the term on the right, the term that's sort of half between what I know and half between what I don't know? And we do the same computation. But because I normalize by the right, I can't also normalize by the left. We can't play the same trick twice. So when I contract to the left, I'm going to get some kind of an arbitrary thing that's like this. I call this a boundary contraction. So it's a tensor. I took this, and I contract them. I do the computation, and I pull it all the way back in. So in order to compute the energy of the terms on the right-hand side, in particular this one, which depends on what I have and what I don't have, I need to know this boundary contraction. What's important, though, is that it's the only thing that I need to know. I don't care what T1, T2, et cetera are. The only thing that I care is when I do the contraction, how is this? Because when I compute the energy here, the only thing it depends on is what's the value of that. And now this thing here is a pretty small object. Sorry, I have it here. If you look at what's the dimensions of these tensors, there's these two legs, which were physical legs, d-dimensional. This is a constant. And then there's the bond dimension here, b. So we're going to see a little bit more about what you need to choose b later. Let's say we only know about the area law. So b needs to be polynomial in n. Fine. But it's some fixed polynomial in n, which doesn't depend on the size of my set or anything like this. It's just a polynomial. So one thing I can do is I can look at the space of all possible contractions. And this space is going to be, say I take an epsilon net. This is going to be a space that has size exponential in the bond dimension, so exponential in my polynomial. And now, among all the candidates that I had for the left half, the only thing that matters about them is two things. One is how much energy do they have with respect to left-hand side terms, which is a number I can compute and associate to them. And second is what is the boundary contraction that they have. If two terms have the same energies on the left and the same contraction, then they're just as good for my purposes. If one of them has an extension that's close to the ground state, then the other one also has. Because this property of having an extension that has a certain energy only depends on the contraction plus the energy on the left. So this is saying that even if I had a huge amount of candidates for the left-hand side, I can restrict myself to what I said so far is an exponential number of candidates. We're going to see that we can make this smaller later by making this bond dimension a little bit smaller. I can restrict myself to, but at least what's important is it's a fixed size set. It doesn't depend on how many I had. It's a fixed size set that's governed simply by how many contractions do I need to consider. I go over all contractions, and for every possible contraction, if it exists, I keep the left half that has that particular contraction. And if there's more than one, I keep the one that among those that has the smallest energy with respect to the left-hand side. That lets me, that is something that's going to let me reduce the size of the set. I'll say more, a little bit more about it later. One thing that I said a little bit quickly, though, is that if I allow this bond dimension to be polynomial, this is going to be exponential. So I kind of have an exponential set of candidates. I don't want this. I want to keep my size polynomial. To keep the size polynomial, what we'll do is that we'll have to restrict this bond dimension to actually be a constant, not polynomial. It's just to be a constant, depending on the precision. And if you look a little bit into the proofs of the area law, especially more recent proofs of the area law, this is allowed. You can find good approximations to the ground state that have constant bond dimension across just one bond, not the others. The others need to be polynomial size. The problem with doing that is that you get only a constant approximation. So by setting this to a constant, and this to be, well, it could be constant size or polynomial size, doesn't matter. What I'm going to have is I'm going to be able to keep very few vectors, just polynomial number of vectors. But the problem is I'm going to make a constant error because of that. So my delta, this approximation error, will become a constant instead of inverse polynomial. If I want to do this n times, it's not going to work out. I can't make a constant error at every step and repeat my steps n times. So in order to allow ourselves to do this, I have to explain the third and last ingredient of the algorithm, which is a procedure to improve the error. So this step, but I'll say this again later, this step is going to involve making a constant error. And then the last tool is a way to recover from such errors. So these are sort of navigation errors in your slide, your little walk along the lake here. So our goal, remember, is to stay on solid ice. So we want to keep good approximations. And let's say I sort of decrease the quality of my variable set. It's only making a constant quality approximation. I want to improve that. How do I do it? And so we have a tool that allows us just to do that. So this tool is called approximate ground state projection. It's an operator that has certain properties. So I'll tell you what the properties are. Later, I'll tell you how to construct the operator. So think of this as just an operator that acts on the whole space. It has three properties. One property is that it's a local operator in the sense that I can decompose it as a product of terms. And each of these terms is local. It acts only on two nearest neighbor qubits. So it's almost like a Hamiltonian, except it's going to be a product instead of a sum. Actually, it's going to be a sum of products. But let's say it's local in an intuitive sense for now. It has two important properties. One is when you apply this operator to the ground state, then it leaves it unchanged. So it doesn't touch the ground state. But if you apply it to a vector that's orthogonal to the ground state, any vector orthogonal to the ground, that gets shrunk by some factor, 1 minus delta, some constant, right, 0.9 or something like this. So it has this effect. If you look at the ground state, this arrow like this pointing up, this operator doesn't touch it. But the whole space that's orthogonal to the ground state is getting contracted by the application of the operator. This is something that was introduced in work by Arad, Lando, and Vazirani. They used it as a tool to understand entanglement in ground states. Eventually, they used it as a tool to prove or reprove Hastings' area law with better parameters. But the sort of construction, so I have a construction of this, but it's a very inefficient construction. Their goal was different. They were really focusing on quantifying the entropy, not in having any efficient procedure. So in this work, what we do is a construction of such an operator that is efficient. It can be efficiently applied as part of the algorithm. And the construction relies on the Hamiltonian being, yes, gap.
Does that projection the ground state invariant exactly or up to some
no,
error?
No, up to some error, eventually. It could be exact if I didn't insist on it being local or efficiently applicable, then it would be exact. But it's actually not exact. It would be exact if the system was unfrustrated. Sorry. Other questions? So you see, I'll give you the construction. It's basically the last technical thing I want to say. I will say. First, I want to sort of put things together and go over the algorithms of step by step. Make sure everyone is following. You can stop questions. I put the definition of these variable sets here up on the board again. I hope you remember what these were meant to be, right? So it's these sets that we're constructing progressively and that contain in their span, let's say, the left Schmidt vectors of a good approximation to the ground state. And so the goal is to construct such a thing for I equals n, and we're going to start from I equals 1. So I equals 1, it's pretty easy because you're just considering one qubit. Actually, here I'm considering zero qubits, so it's even more trivial. I mean, if you're not, you have a set on zero qubits, it's just a convention. I could set it to anything. Even if I just wanted to construct it for I equals 1, I just have one qubit. What thing I could take is just a basis for the whole space of one qubit, right? That would have d elements. And of course, I have a basis of the whole space, so it does contain a good approximation to anything, right? So it would be fine, and it would be correct with some, it would be exact, so the error would be zero in that case. So getting started is easy. And the point is to see how we perform every step. So let's suppose that we've arrived at step I minus 1. So we have such a viable set on the first I minus 1 qubits with some good approximation quality and a certain size, that's some polynomial size. So it looks something like this, right? A bunch of matrix product states that live on the qubits up to I minus 1. And we want to extend this one more qubit. We're going to do it in three steps. So first step is sort of the trivial step. We consider one more qubit and extend trivially, like this. Extend in all possible ways by extending each of these matrix product states and concatenating it with each of the possible d basis vectors for the space of my next qubit. So now clearly, if this contained a good approximation to the ground state to the left half, then this also does, because I considered all possible extensions. So this is completely fine. The one thing that's not fine about it is that each vector now, each matrix product state, now I have d of them, one for each possible state. So my size got multiplied by d. So I can't do this n times. So the other steps are sort of trying to deal with this, this blow up in size, which is all the snow that we're pulling up. There's two steps corresponding to two tools I talked about before. The first one is to reduce the size using this decoupling idea. That will be successful in reducing the size to some fixed polynomial. The problem that this step has that I already mentioned is that in order to reduce to a polynomial size, which we'll do by considering all the possible contractions, remember these boundary contractions, which are the objects that you get by contracting the left half, but with a constant b here, I'm going to iterate over all these, a very pretty fine net over the space of all these. This is why I get polynomial, not a constant. And for each such contraction, I look, you know, is it possible to create it using vectors in the span of my set? If it's possible, I'll choose the combination that has the minimal energy and keep just the corresponding vectors. So if I can get this one in this way, but also maybe in another way, I'll get rid of the other way. So this will get my set small. But to get it small to really polynomial size, I need to have constant bond dimension. Constant bond dimension is fine, but the consequence it'll have is that if this contained a pretty good approximation, even if delta was very small, now the approximation quality I have is only 1/10. So the last step is sort of has to recover from that error before we can go on. And that's the application of the AGSP. So it's saying if you have a certain set of a certain size and a certain approximation quality, you're going to apply an operator to each of the vectors in your set in order to improve the approximation quality. The application of this operator will result in a little bit of a blow up in the size of the set. But because we started from a fixed polynomial, we'll end up with another fixed polynomial. What's important is the quality of the parameters here that we get in the end, delta and s, do not depend on the delta and s that I had originally. This could have been pretty big. This could have been pretty small. Doesn't matter. I'm going to reset things to 1 over n squared and s some, you know, n to the 10 or something, or maybe something worse, at the end of my three procedures here. And then we just go on. So that's it. I just have to tell you, well, first step is pretty trivial. So let me go over steps 2 and 3 again. They just apply the ideas that I introduced in previous slides. But we have maybe 10 minutes left or something. So I'll just make them a little bit more precise. All right, so step 2, which is the decoupling step. OK, here I really don't have that much more to say. So the important thing that we're using that I mentioned is that as a result, not of Hissing's real law, but of this improved real law, actually as a result of the techniques used to prove that improved real law, you have the following stronger consequence or different kind of consequence, which is that if I fix a constant eta, think of eta as being 1 over 10 or 1 over 100, then I can find a constant approximation to the ground state that has bond dimension polynomial across all the bonds, except one. Any one that I'm interested in, I can make this dimension a constant. So using that, you can see that the set of contractions that you need to iterate over in your decoupling step only needs to consider, well, this is d, and this b here is polynomial in this approximation you want, so it's just a constant. So it's a constant dimensional space. But I'll take a net that's pretty fine, a fine grid, like 1 over n, 1 over n squared. So I'll get a net of size that's polynomial in the end, polynomial in n. And so this is what we do. I've said this before. Let me not repeat it. Maybe I should say a little bit how, you know, given a fixed contraction, I said we look at all possible ways to realize that contraction from the vectors that we have. And among all these possible ways, we choose the one that has the minimal energy. If I do this naively, it's not going to be efficient, because I have a set that has polynomially many vectors. There's many different ways to combine these vectors together. So potentially, if I do exhaustive search, I would again, this step would take exponential time. So I have to explain how I can do it in polynomial time. And the explanation is pretty simple. You can write it as a convex program. So you can think of that step as a convex optimization problem. It's minimizing the energy over all density matrices that are supported on my set. And the set has polynomial size, so that's a polynomial size space. And there's the condition, which is that these reduced density matrices should match the contraction that I'm currently considering. Every possible contraction, polynomially many of them, I'm going to solve this. And then the solution will give me the matrix product states that I keep for the next iteration. The only thing that's missing is making this precise. Let's say it's a trace norm approximation. Anyways, any kind of norm you'd get a convex program. Because I'm actually in constant dimensions, I could use any kind of norm, doesn't matter. So I can actually make this, for those who care, in a semi-definite program or something like this. So I can solve this very efficiently. So that's no problem. All right, last step, improving the error. Sort of the maybe interesting step, or the new step of the algorithm. So we want to perform this. And I said before, the way we're going to do this is using this operator. So let me tell you why, if I have such an operator, I can achieve the step. Next slide, I'll give you the construction of the operator, and then we'll be done. OK, so why is this enough in order to perform this? Well, first, let's think of this gamma, which is the ground state, or a good approximation to the ground state, such that the left half, or the left Schmidt vectors, are supported. So this should be span of the set. And this good approximation is like, you know, it has some constant overlap on the ground state and some small overlap on the orthogonal complement. This is the promise that I have from this being a viable set. Now let's imagine that we knew gamma. We know the whole approximation. Then we can apply the operator to it, right, a sufficient number of times. And then just by the property that it leaves this component invariant, or essentially invariant, and it shrinks the other component, after renormalization, so this should, I should have renormalized here, I get something that has now a much larger overlap on the ground state and a small overlap on the complement. So I have a much better approximation just by applying the operator. Only subtlety is that I don't know this gamma, right? I don't know the whole thing. I only have the left half. My operator is something that acts on the whole space. So how do I do that? How do I do it efficiently? So here, I'm going to use the fact that it's local. I only have this. And I want to apply my operator, and it's local. So it has, like, for instance, it has terms like this that act on what I have. And I can apply these, do the sort of tensor network computation here. But then one day, I encounter a term that sort of wants to act on something I have and something I don't have. Then I continue. So this is my operator. The only question is, how do I apply this? I can't apply this because I haven't done the next step yet, right? Well, one way to do it is just to decompose it, write it as a MPO, or decompose it as a linear combination of tensor products. This term I can apply. This term, I don't know what it's going to apply to, but it's going to apply to something. So what I'll do is I'll just consider all possibilities. I'll plug in here this red line, again, a basis, d possible choices. Actually, it doesn't matter because it's a tensor product. Rather, what I'll say, sorry, is that I'll just apply this bk for every possible k. And k will range, you know, I guess this is d, k is at most d squared, right? So I get d squared possibilities for here. And so as this happens more and more times, I get more and more vectors. And this is why the size of my set, I said, increases when I apply the operator. It's really a result of the fact that I only have the left half. And so every time I want to apply something that acts across the border, I need to keep track of all possible ways this could be defined, sort of what the bond to the right could be telling me. And for all these possible ways, I get a different matrix product state. So I get a bigger set. But as long as this doesn't happen too often, and with our construction, it doesn't happen too often, then the size blow up in your set is something that's manageable. So this is how you do this step. You just define it like this, in this way. You take the original set, and then each vector in the original set, you apply this approximate ground state projection in that sense. So you apply it like this. And when you have a term that cuts across, terms to the right, you don't care. Terms that cut across, you split them open, and you add all possibilities to the new set.
By this.
Right. So it's going to be related to the depth, right? So every time, basically, one way to think about it is that every time I apply something across here, I can compute a matrix product state representation for the next guy, where the bond dimension here has been multiplied by d squared. D squared is sort of the maximum entanglement increase. Mm-hmm. So this multiplies this by d squared. This again by d squared. This doesn't touch this guy, but it multiplies this guy. So as long as each column contains a logarithmic number of terms, I'm good.
Right. And it doesn't increase, but and that's then you're going to deal with that in the next step.
Oh, there's not. Oh, I see. I didn't say that. Good point. Yes.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
This actually, I'm not. It's sort of straightforward, but it's you definitely have to do it because you're right. There's actually two things that increase, not only the number of vectors, but sort of their complexity in terms of the bond dimension. And what you can do is simply, at the end of this step, you can just truncate. So as a consequence of the area law of these, or of these stronger area laws, and a little bit of sort of manipulation, but I think this is pretty standard, you can show that
for a fixed approximation quality that you want, there's going to be a fixed sort of polynomial level at which you can truncate all your Schmidt coefficients. So you order the Schmidt coefficients here, and you keep only the polynomially many largest, where polynomially many is just a fixed polynomial, always the same throughout the algorithm. So you do this truncation at every step, you're right. All right, 2 minutes to explain how we construct this operator. It's actually pretty simple. I'm going to describe it in the frustration-free case. It's simpler. If it's frustrated, it's just a tiny bit, the scaling is just a tiny bit more complicated. So let's just assume that the ground state has zero energy, and there's a gap. So every vector orthogonal to the ground state has, you know, some amount of energy, delta. And so the natural thing to do in this I learned, you know, if you're a physicist, like everyone in this room except me, probably, the natural thing would be to consider not exactly this, but just the, you know, e to the minus th, right? So you can think as this is e to the minus th for a particular set of t, but I'm going to think of it just like this. When you take my Hamiltonian, scale it by its total norm, take 1 minus this, so this is a positive operator, and raise it to the n. Okay, what is the effect of that operator? When I apply to the ground state, because the ground state has energy 0, I'm just doing the identity, and it's left invariant. Good. What happens when I apply it to something that's orthogonal to the ground state? Then the energy with respect to h is delta, so I get 1 minus delta over n raised to the n. This is roughly e to the minus delta, so I saw this is an approximation here. It's with roughly 1 minus delta. So if you look at what's the norm of this operator applied to something orthogonal to the ground state, you have that this norm has shrunk by a factor multiplicative 1 minus delta, just using the fact that this vector needs to have energy at least delta. So it has properties 2 and 3. That's good. But the key property is really property 1, right? That's the thing that you care about, whether you can apply the thing. So let's think about that. Well, if I expand my operator, so I have this n to the n scaling here that I'm putting outside, and then I can write h as a sum, right? And this, by writing identity as n identities divided by n and splitting all the identities, I can write it as this, identity minus h1 plus identity minus h2 plus identity minus h3, et cetera. These are positive terms because all my h's had norm at most 1. And so now I can expand this, and when I expand it, what do I get? I forgot the normalization, but apart from that, I get a huge sum of products, right? Where these products are just the products of terms that come from this, any terms. So for instance, well, 1 minus h1 times 1 minus h1, et cetera, times 1 minus h1, this shows up. But also 1 minus h1 times 1 minus h3 times 1 minus h4, this shows up. So I have all these terms. And how many terms do I have n to the n of them? So there's one good thing, one bad thing. One good thing is that this is a local operator, right? Because each of these are local. So I'm just applying sort of the complement of these, or identity minus h, n times. The problem is I have exponentially many terms, right? So the one trick that you need to do here, or the one idea, is to subsample. So instead of considering the operator that applies all these terms, or an average such term, if you take into account the normalization condition, here's how you define your AGSP. So that's the exact definition here, except for normalization. There should be a normalization by the number of terms. You're going to approximate this big sum by a smaller sum, which only considers, instead of exponentially many terms, just polynomially many terms. Which terms? Just choose them at random. So among the exponentially many possibilities, choose a polynomial number of them, and try to approximate this operator by this operator, which is the sum over only polynomially many terms. Is this going to work? Is this not going to work? Turns out it's going to work. This is a consequence of concentration bounds that are known for matrices. So this is matrix-valued Chernoff bounds. I didn't put the reference. The one that we use here is due to Trop. It's recent, but these bounds, they're started in the late 90s in quantum information. I think one that's most known is by Alschwede and Winter. This is the first such bound. We use a little bit sort of improved bounds here. But what they'll tell you is that if you take this many terms, then this operator is an approximation to this operator in operator norm, so a very strong approximation with this amount of error, eta. And we can make eta inverse polynomially small, as inverse polynomially small as we want. This error, Olivier, will be some error that you get, and that will mean that even though the original guy preserves the ground space, the new guy will only preserve it up to inverse polynomial, for whatever inverse polynomial that you want. So there's a little bit of an error here that I'm sort of glossing over. But if you do that, then it's going to have the properties that you have before. You have to be a little bit careful. When we looked at how we were going to apply this previously, and this was not Dan's question, but the way I answered Dan's question,
which was you want to make sure that when you have these terms here, there's not too many of them that act across any one bond. They should be, so there's n terms. To get a better approximation, we'll take a bit more. We'll end up taking n log n terms. You want to make sure that they don't act, all of them, across the same bond. Otherwise, the bond, the dimension of that bond will blow up. But you can do an argument saying that if you choose only polynomially many such terms, just because there's actually, there are terms, like 1 minus h1, 1 minus h1, 1 minus h1, this keeps acting across the first bond. That's bad. That's just one term. And if you select at random these many terms among exponentially many, the chance that you get one that acts more than logarithmically many times, too many times across any one bond, will be small enough that you can sort of neglect it. So you have to make the argument, but it works out. OK, I'm out of time. Sorry, I'm done. There was a recap, but I think I've said this enough times, probably, so the three steps. So let me not recap it. Let me just we'll summarize and maybe raise a couple of sort of questions. I mean, so that's the main result that I described. Sorry, that's the main result. That was the overview. So the result is that we have this this algorithm, and so there's some interesting questions. I mean, one is that this is not a practical algorithm. Like, it's a provable polynomial time algorithm, but I don't think you want to run it in practice. Just the parameters are just too bad. Even if you sort of tweak things a little bit, it's unlikely that you'd beat DMRG. DMRG is very fast and it works all the time. One thing that could be interesting, though, is to take some of the ingredients, like, for instance, this idea of this operator, the AGSP, and incorporate them into DMRG to maybe make it not more efficient, might be a little bit less efficient, but it, you know, might have better guarantees. It might help you get out of these, like, few cases where DMRG gets stuck. Or at least studying to what extent this can be done, I think this would be an interesting question. Those are the really exciting questions. They're related to what can you do beyond one-dimensional systems, right? So the main open questions in the area, they're related to what can you do in two dimensions. So two dimensions we don't even have an area law. So one thing is whether some of the ideas can be used to prove an area law. Also, you could say, well, let me assume there's an area law. And a lot of people do this, right? When you work with PEPs, you're just saying, well, I'm just going to assume that there's a good PEPs for my ground state, maybe. And then the question would be, assuming this PEPs exists, can you find it, right? Can you perform optimization over it? So that I don't know, but it's a question. You can also look at other generalization in 1D. For instance, what if there's a gap, but the ground state is ground space is degenerate? Does the algorithm work? I don't know. Or what if there's no gap, but there's some assumption on the density of states above the ground space? Does it work? I don't know. But maybe, you know, so it would be some interesting things to look at here. OK, but I'll stop out of time. Thank you.
Questions for Tom? So for pushing this to higher dimensions, so if I promise you that the ground set has an area law, is the only thing that really prevents it from working this decoupling thing? So in other words, if I gave you a black box procedure, which kind of does a PEPs construction for this, for the particular case that you want to, I think 1 over n squared precision, which is the size of the epsilon net in this decoupling,
Would you mean by a black box that does the PEPs?
Well, like, I mean, if I gave you some, just kind of like some procedure that, by magic, that does a PEPs construction.
Of the ground state?
Yeah. Would your algorithm work in higher dimensions?
So I didn't understand, because you're telling me you're giving me a black box that solves the problem, and then you're asking.
No, for a PEPs contraction.
Oh, that contracts PEPs.
Yeah.
If I forget about the fact that it's hard to contract PEPs, I see. No, not that I know. One objection is that even in 1D, if you promise me that there's an area law,
mm-hmm.
this is not enough for the algorithm, right? And it's
provably
not enough. So what you need is this gap condition, and you need the gap condition in order to construct this AGSP. So in two dimensions, I don't even know how to.
Yeah, but your AGSP condition doesn't. Your AGSP construction doesn't rely on the fact that it's 1D.
It doesn't rely on the dimension, that's true. Okay, that's true. So I guess the other thing is the contraction, right? So you said that is an objection, okay.
I mean, the
possibly.
the AKSP kind of relies on the 1D, because you have this business about things going over the boundary, and if the boundary is larger.
Yeah, if the boundary is larger, I think because that was just, you had to split up these terms, and then you need to account for this splitting. I think if you have a vertical boundary, I see, each time, yeah, you have to see how many times you act across the boundary, but I guess if it's a linear number of times, linear length of the boundary. Right here, I did use the fact that only logarithmically many terms in total acted across the boundary, because
right.
It blows up by multiplicative at every time. So that would be another issue.
Anything else? No, let's thank Thomas again.